CataractCoach.com podcast series number 9, today with Vance Thompson. Vance Thompson is an ophthalmologist specializing in cataract and refractive surgery in Sioux City, South Dakota. Here in the USA, he's since expanded to other sites in different states, and he's best known for his patient experience. So it's not a typical doctor's clinic where you go, check in, waiting in a waiting room, then get seen, then get treated, then go. No, it's an entire experience. And he really takes pride in that. Of course, he's got amazing staff members. He has an amazing team of surgeons there who do beautiful surgery. But it's also the patient experience. And so we talked for about an hour all about that patient experience. And even I went away with some amazing ideas that I want to incorporate into my own practice. So I know you're going to enjoy this podcast. Remember, we also have this available on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Google, wherever you get your podcast from. You can download it, listen to it while you're working out or going for a walk. And you can also watch it, of course, on YouTube and, of course, on CataractCoach.com. Remember, too, starting in June, we're going to do a new podcast every week. Check it out. So welcome to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, we're talking to Vance Thompson from Vance Thompson Vision. Vance is a visionary. And the thing I admire the most about him is he delivers an incredible patient experience. It's like I want to be a patient in his practice. So welcome, Vance. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Uday. It really means a lot.
So tell me how this all started, because you obviously started your initial clinic there in South Dakota, but you've now expanded to multiple states and, what, at least a half dozen clinics?
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up in this state of South Dakota, my dad, small town family doctor, and my grandpa, thinking I would be the same in medical school, fell in love with ophthalmology, did a, you know, in the end, a fellowship in refractive and cataract surgery. And I just remember starting my practice in the early 90s and, you know, just, you know, having some frustrations, and we can talk about what led to the patient experience. But I really think what's led to the expansion is just having amazing partners and amazing people. And I never dreamt we would expand, didn't, you know, even want to. Always had a philosophy, if you build it, meaning, you know, world's best technology and great people, that the patients will come. And I have to say it was Mike Greenwood who really was our, you know, first fellow that said, I really want to be VTV in where I grew up. And that was, you know, Fargo, North Dakota. And then, you know, we had always said to, you know, because when someone does a fellowship with you, you kind of fall in love with each other.
For
and
sure.
You know how it is. And so we, you know, basically, you know, usually just told our fellows, you know, if there wasn't a need, you know, no, go get a job. You know, everybody wants to practice together, you
sure.
know, and when you've spent a year together. And he was just amazing in that he went and looked for a job, but in the end said, I really want this culture. And that's what then led to, you know, Montana and then Nebraska and Iowa, Minnesota. And, you know, it's just the growth has been amazing. We now have 7 total centers. So
wow, that's amazing. So I guess the key to the whole expansion then is just great people.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the foundation. Yet, you know, I get to work with these, you know, rock stars and just wonderful people and wonderful doctors, surgeons, and, you know, have had the honor of being involved in a lot of research and development, and really value industry relationships, technology, and all these things. And in the end, when you know, sit around at night and you're talking with your partners about, you know, why, what attracted you. The most common theme I hear is, you know, and this is where you probably need to prepare for a little bit of mushiness, Uday. But the most common thing I hear is, you know, because you love me. And so people really want to feel loved and cared for. And the same thing that makes a great, you know, work family is what, you know, makes a great family.
So I think, like, for you, then the 3 kind of principles of your practice are, as you said, great technology, got to be world leading technology, always bringing the cutting edge, the best. Second is you want to have a great culture and great people that you work with. And then the last thing is what I'm most enthralled with, is an incredible patient experience. You're not just the typical clinic where you come in, you wait in a waiting room, you get a treatment, you go home. It's much more than that. And so would it be fair that those are the three kind of main pillars then?
It really is. I mean, we also have a pillar that we call do the right thing.
Of course.
So when you're at that crossroads of you know, that you can, you know, be excellent or, you know, not, you know, that we really, you know, want to be excellent in everything we do.
Yeah, so it's what I tell my residents when I was teaching. I actually retired from teaching residents last year after 22 years. But I would always teach, give the same high level of care that you want to receive. It's that easy.
Yes, yes, the golden rule.
Yeah, we learned it in kindergarten, right, at age 5.
Yes, yes. Well, and you know that people want to know how much you care before how much you know. You want to develop you need to connect.
So in your practice, how have you honed that patient experience? What's the patient experience like? I have not yet visited your clinic. I'm long overdue to come visit. But tell me, when does the patient experience start and what's it like?
Well, you know, the start really does have something to do with where we're at, because for me, it was a decade of, you know, kind of frustration. You know, I absolutely love the practice of ophthalmology, and my focus is refractive surgery of the cornea, phakic IOL lens. I've focused my career on that, but I felt like I, even though I had a great group of people I was working with, that I had more patient complaints and staff complaints mm-hmm. than, you know, a nice person should have. And I'll never forget telling my brother-in-law, who was the head of a hospital system here in Sioux Falls, about my frustrations. And he suggested I learn what a lot of doctors, you know, haven't learned along the way through medical school and everything, and that is more about people and the business of medicine. And so I, you know, went and took a course down in Boca Raton that they sent their doctors to, called the International Council for Quality Care, ICQC. It really started my journey of understanding, you know, even things like, you know, if you sit there with your back to the patient working on your EMR and you spend 15 minutes with the patient, or you spend 3 minutes and you come in and you have a handshake and you, you know, have eye contact and you have a smile and you connect and you're with them, you're present for those 3 minutes, that those patients are way happier and feel like they spent more time with you. And so I learned so many things like that. But really, the game changer was when, you know, Sharif Madhavi introduced me to a guy by the name of Jim Gilmore at, you know, an academy. And Jim Gilmore is the co-author of the book, The Experience Economy, that him and Joe Pyne wrote. And Jim Gilmore, who talks about work as theater and every business is a stage, and that, you know, really we had passed the, you know, service economy. If you didn't have a, you know, good service, you don't have a business. That what people really want is to be moved. And if you could create an experience, that you were going to really thrive in modern day business. And so Jim Gilmore suggested, you know, getting 7 practices together in this country, across the country, where we would study his ways and we would go to different cities and we would walk through different businesses, whether it was the Ritz or the American Girl doll store or different highly experiential places, and then sit down and say, how does this transfer to the practice of medicine and patient care? How do we create a world-class patient experience by looking at what other businesses have done? And that started a sequence of meeting other people like John DeJulius, the author of Secret Service, who, you know, has this hair salon in Cleveland, who, you know, would do things like all the new people would have on white capes and all the established people would have on black capes. And when his staff would walk by a white cape person, they would say, "Oh, I understand it's your first day with us," with smile and eye contact. And the white cape person is like, "How do all these people know it's my first day?" And they're, screaming with this white cape. But we would learn things like that about how to surprise and delight our patients. Yeah. And I took Matt Jensen with me, who was our CEO for 20 years, who is the CEO of Matt Jensen Marketing. And Matt, I wanted him to learn every step of the way because I knew I was going to be in the operating room and I wanted him to be working with the team on how do we take these principles and try to be the best we can be in our patient experience.
Yeah, that's so important. But it's interesting how you can learn from a business that you wouldn't think relates to ophthalmology, like the Ritz-Carlton or the American Girl doll store, and just learn from what they've done and then apply it to your own practice. That's so interesting. So it must go ahead.
I just want to say that, even though we were highly focused on the patient experience, what also was evolving over time was this idea about the importance of the team.
Sure.
Because, I always had really valued my team. And in medicine, we're taught about, the patient comes first. And sometimes I feel, Uday, in the practice of medicine, that doctors will almost hide behind the patient comes first as a license to treat the staff less than. And so certain situations, certain temperaments come out, and including with me, I'm human. And patient care has its stresses.
Sure.
But what I started noticing over time was really what was even more important was the team experience. And so I started developing a philosophy that the team who loves and cares for each other will create an environment where the patient feels loved and cared for. And so to tell you the truth, the part that we started focusing on more than anything was, educating and empowering our team, buying the same books, doing the same thing that Jim Gilmore did with us or John DeJulius did with us, but doing it with our team. Mm. And it is amazing what happens with organizational effectiveness when your team has these tools, because you can be in the operating room and your leaders can be doing what they do, but when your team is feeling not only empowered, but feeling this purpose that it's way beyond just having a job, that they're touching lives and they're helping to create the experience, it's amazing what happens. And I'll just give you one example that happened on those retreats. The team didn't like the way a lot of doctors' offices would treat them by, someone coming out into the waiting room and saying their name, rather loudly, and other people hearing it. So the team created a map of all the chairs and couches that are in our front atrium. We don't like the phrase waiting room, but,
sure,
technically it would be where the patients are waiting for the next step.
Sure.
The patient has had a great phone experience. They've come in, they're greeted up front with, smile and an eye contact, because there's nothing more powerful, than that body language. And so we have just wonderful people at the front that we call our first impressions team, and our phone people are on the first impressions team. So there's kind of a coordinated touching of the patient to start this journey, but there's a map. And so in chair F7, Mrs. Johnson is sitting with a brown sweater and a black pea coat and a little description of her so that Anna can walk right up to her.
Yeah. You don't have to call her name
out. And look her
right
in the eye and say, "Mrs. Johnson, I'm Anna. I'm your technician. Welcome to Vance Thompson Vision." And then you start the journey. And it's just an example of when you close clinic and you tell your team how important they are to creating this experience, and then you start to develop these breakout sessions and certain things, you know, rise to the top and over time become a part of the fiber of your practice.
Yeah, you need that whole team. It's like you just can't have a great pitcher and have a winning baseball team. You got to have the whole team.
Right.
It's funny, on Cataract Coach, this week I've been posting videos about surgical efficiency, and I have a video where I have the phone on the wall of my OR, and I show that my scrub tech is as important as me in doing the surgery. I can't operate in a vacuum. I have to have that her high level of skill. So it's the whole team. And you said one more thing. You said it's the experience starts even with the phone call before the patient ever sets foot in your clinic.
It even starts before that. It starts with your marketing. What's your message? I call marketing the beginning of informed consent, the beginning of setting the patient expectations. And whether you're driving them to your website or you're driving them to the ultimate action item to actually call your office, that you really want that experience to be thoughtful every step of the way. And I'm amazed how many patients will see me, and I'm asking them, how did they hear about us? And,
sure.
You know, I'm waiting for the, well, I know you guys were involved in the development of laser and implant vision correction or something like that, or you treated my friend. No, I actually called multiple offices, and your phone team was so nice that's why I chose you.
Wow.
It's amazing the different things you hear, but it's amazing how impactful the proper phone first impression can be. And, you know, I'm amazed at the personalities of our phone team, because you walk in and you watch them and they all have these vibrant personalities, and you can see that they're using, if you will, eye contact and a smile, even though they're not seeing a patient. And so it's they're developing a connection over the phone. And it's amazing how powerful that can be for a practice, and not only growing it, but the beginning of the patient experience.
So you have a separate phone team compared to the people who are greeting, or like say receptionist. Those are different people. They're not the same. Because in traditional doctor's clinics, it's often the same person.
We have taken the phone out of the front atrium, and the phone team has their own beautiful space where they have their loved ones' photos and their pets and their sayings and their motivators and their, you know, little snack or whatever. We want them to feel as loved and cared for as each other, and they're a unit. You know, and so it's a totally separate experience, and they're not interrupted by someone walking. And just like the front atrium, first impressions people aren't interrupted by the phone. They each are focusing on that particular stage of the patient experience.
Wow, that's interesting. So yeah, you've invested in different people for different parts of the team. I think that's unusual. I don't think most clinics have a separate phone team versus, you know, front, let's say, reception team or greeting team. They often just combine them.
Right. No, I actually, you know, have the honor of being in the wine business in the Napa Valley, and we actually do the same thing there. We've separated the phone from the greet, because it's amazing how the greet can be interrupted by the phone. And, you know, separating the two can be very powerful. And you know, again, how would you want to be treated? If you're being greeted and then someone says, let me grab the phone, and can you pull that off? Yes, you can. It's just not ideal.
Yeah, it doesn't feel good. If I'm sitting there at the check-in and in the middle of my sentence, they say, oh, could you hold on a second after you answer the phone? Yeah, it's a little frustrating. It's a little...
Right. Well, it's almost like, you know, you're feeling like you come first, and then, oh, can you hang on for a second? You're second. And then you're back to first, and then you're second.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's really focusing on these stages. And it's to tell you the truth, Uday, it really makes it fun when you are working on the experiential side. Because what is more intimate in, you know, that you can do with a fellow human than take care of them medically or surgically?
Sure.
I think a lot of doctors and their teams just don't realize the impact that they're having on patients' lives. And so to take that to another level and work on the how you make them feel part, the experiential side of it, is really kind of, I think, you know, the key to thriving in modern day medicine. I like to call it the big E, you know, the experience, the team experience and the patient experience. It's the key. It's the missing link between a good practice reaching great is the people part.
So when the patient calls in, they get your phone team. The phone team is obviously incredible, connects with the patient. Do you then send the patient educational materials ahead of time before their clinic visit?
Definitely. Because, you know, when we're, you know, trying to help them figure out, is it better to laser their cornea, phakic IOL, lens replacement, all the different options, it's sensory overload. So, sure. You know, having a thoughtful patient education process, you know, really happens in stages also, because, you know, we know that patients forget 70% of what you teach them. And of the 30% that they remember, 50% of that they remember wrong. And so the only way that we can help a patient truly get it is through repetition.
Sure.
And so these materials that are mailed or are on the website, and they're kind of pre-experience assignments, are really critical. And if they come in and they haven't done them, we will, you know, get the iPad out and the headphones and have them watch it in the front atrium. Can we spoon feed them, you know, doing it the traditional way in the, you know, exam room? For sure. And we do a lot of that. Sure. But we would rather that be step 3 or 4, so they're starting to get it, so that conversation is richer and deeper. So repetition is really important in having all your touch points. That's why it's so important to draw out your, you know, in business, they would say your sales cycle, you know, or your customer experience cycle. We call it our patient experience cycle. And, you know, it starts with, you know, however they heard about you first. And then you work through those little boxes of each experience. And how do you theme the educational portion of each one of them so that it all comes together for a beautiful lifetime vision decision?
Yeah, I do something very similar. So, yeah, I send patients via email a link to a video where I'm explaining the things that I'd normally do live in front of them. And I'm surprised at the number of patients who tell me, "Oh, I watched that video like multiple times."
Right.
And so it's like, it's what you're saying. They don't recall the first time. It's common sense to us because it's all we do. But for a patient, right, they have to watch it a few times to really understand it.
And I think there's a couple keys there. One, you took the time to do the video. And so you're starting to connect with the patient already, so that when you walk in that exam room, they're already feeling a relationship.
Sure.
But you know, secondly, it's just this idea of using modern day methods to connect with the patient and be a part of that repetition process is so helpful in their journey. And we use the same, we do the video thing pre and we do it post-op also, trying to really guess, you know, what they're experiencing at 1 day, 1 week, 1 month.
Oh,
and
so
we're sending, you know, multiple videos out. And it's amazing how the patients will say how that brought them, you know, some inner peace.
I'm going to have to copy that. I had never even thought of doing it after. So like on post-op day one, or let's say the evening after surgery, the patient going to get a text and a brief video that says, "Hey, you're probably experiencing this now. The vision's starting to come in. Maybe your pupil's still a little dilated. This is all normal." Kind of just to reaffirm these things with them. That's so brilliant. A post-op video too.
Yeah. The fact of the matter is the thank you notes I get aren't about having, you know, 1,000 hertz femtosecond laser or, you know, the world's most advanced trifocal. The thank you notes are, you know, about how we made them feel, because, you know, and then also those post-op touches, you know, how much they appreciate that text or that video message. Again, people really, you know, what they care about most is how you make them feel.
Yeah, that's wow. That is so important. Yeah, post-op video. Never even thought of that. That's a brilliant idea. So for your patients, are you mostly then word of mouth, mostly marketing, mostly referred in by other docs? What's your traditional kind of mix?
Well, number one is word of mouth. I don't think there's anything more powerful.
Sure.
And I think that, and then second would be doctor referral. We, you know, work hard at educating, you know, the doctors that we get the honor of working with. But I also think that, you know, a lot of doctors will offer a patient, you know, a few choices. They have a list of practices that they trust. And so, you know, doing some, you know, marketing and having a quality website and, you know, having patients hear from other patients increases the chance that when a doctor presents that list that the patient chooses you. So I always say word of mouth is number one, and doctor referral is number two, but both are extremely important.
Yeah, I think for me especially, I think I'd agree with you. It's all about the word of mouth. The word of mouth is huge. And you end up seeing the patterns in your practice like, oh yeah, I heard about you from this friend and that friend. And we all go to the same kind of club together, or we play golf together. Or it's like, wow, you're just the word of mouth really gets around. And you're right. The word of mouth is, of course, they have to have a great outcome, a great vision, and they're happy with that. But more importantly, it's how they felt in your practice. They felt cared for, how they were taken care of, and exactly what was the experience like. So a patient comes into your clinic. They go in. They meet the experience, the front, let's say the greeting team or the experience team. So you have a technician that take the patient and then start some of the workup? What's it like?
Yes. Well, so the technician has walked, again, right up to them, and there's smile, there's eye contact, there's an introduction, they're developing a connection first, they're starting a conversation, they're trying to relax the patient. And then they're also starting the diagnostics. And so when they're doing something like, you know, measuring, you know, a topography or measuring, you know, the, you know, high order aberration state of the eye or doing tear film analysis or, you know, doing an A-scan, that what they're doing is they're talking about those procedures and why we do them. It's such a beautiful part of the patient education process. It also relaxes the patient so that each movement is purposeful. If patients are moved too much and they're not explained to why or they're not communicated enough with, it builds anxiety, and anxiety lessens their receptiveness to learn. And so if we're teaching them and being conversational and having purpose to each movement, each step, choreographed, but yet, you know, there's also each technician has their own unique way of doing things, and we want them to influence that also. But patients really value being educated on the diagnostics. And then once you go through the diagnostics that are set up in a very organized way, and I will add that before we built our center, you know, we spent 3 months talking about our patient flow. Our center was built on the patient experience. And so when they go from the front atrium to the diagnostics, it's, you know, a 15-second walk. And when they get through the diagnostics, it's, you know, a 20-second walk to get to your exam room. And the front atrium, of course, is what we would call on stage. That's what we call patient, you know, facing. And when we're going through the diagnostics and to the hallway that goes to the exam room, that's on stage. And they go in the exam room, that's on stage. And when you're on stage, you want to make sure, you know, the magazines are in order and that, you know, things are clean and there's not crumble from the last patient's cookie or, you know, and I don't know if you've ever heard about the study on airlines, but patients who saw a coffee stain on, you know, the airline, you know, where they were going to sit, were afraid the airplane's going to go down, you know.
Oh,
and
wow.
So,
yeah,
it,
yeah.
It, you know,
the
patient, the little things that build patient confidence. So making sure that everything is very orderly. And then when you go into the exam room, if we've really nailed it, your soft drink or your favorite beverage is sitting there and your music is playing on Pandora, and whether it's country or, you know, jazz. And so if we've really nailed it, we know these things that are, you know, really mean something to them. And then, you know, sit down and load the four opter and do those things and, you know, start the EMR process. And then, you know, on the other side of the exam room is the door where the technicians sit and where the doctor comes from. And if the patient walked through that door, that would be, you know, off stage, because sure, that's where the technicians have their desks and the doctors have their desks, and they're a little bit more relaxed with their, you know, loved ones' photos, just like the phone team has sure, their little area. They have their area. And that doesn't have to be as, you know, crisp and clean, because again, it's off stage. And so to design your exam rooms with patient coming in one door from onstage, doctor coming in from the other door from offstage, really sets up a great patient experience. So when the technician is done in that exam room, they then turn on the lighting system that we have that helps everyone to know where the doctor's needed and where the doctor is. Because when the doctor then comes into that room that has their light and they push the button, then everybody knows where the doctor is. And so the whole thing is very, you know, choreographed. And then when the doctor's done with their exam discussion, and usually in, you know, the way that we do it in our galleys is we have this, you know, kind of beautiful choreography with optometry and ophthalmology. So the optometrists are helping with the exam and the patient education after the technician. And then when the patients feel like they, you know, really have a good exam, we have a good understanding, they're close to that final decision, then the ophthalmologist goes in and helps them with that final decision and, you know, looks at what they want to look at and reviews everything. And then, you know, we prepare them for surgery. And some people, you know, travel a ways and do what we call see and do's, and they're doing their, whether it's LASIK or, you know, a phakic IOL or lens replacement, they're doing their exam in one, you know, time period. And then that same day, doing their surgery. We call it a see and do. But then after the doctor, then the counselor will see them, and either they then, you know, go home, or they, you know, and surgery a different day, or they, you know, go to surgery. But there's, you know, a cycle that if you watch the patient footsteps is almost a circular fashion that is very themed and choreographed and very smooth, and the whole place was designed around the patient experience.
So it's even just like the layout then of the entire clinic is, it flows. So atrium to patient testing to, let's say, exam room with the optometrist starting, then the ophthalmologist, then to the surgical counselor, and then either surgery or to book a surgery or to do the surgery that same day. So it really is like,
exactly,
there's no cross traffic. You don't have to walk back and forth across the clinic. You're moving in essentially one flow of the river.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Wow, that's a really neat idea. It's a very different way of thinking about it.
It's fun when you can design a physical space around a patient experience.
So even your satellite
and a team experience.
So your satellite, you set up this, all the satellites set up kind of the same way then.
Yep, they are. And so, you know, at different stages of your practice journey, you can afford different levels of physical plant. And so sometimes we're needing to work into a space, into a building that's, you know, was previously built. And so you have to be creative. In our current space, we built the building and, you know, from the ground up with the patient experience in mind, but that's a more mature practice than some of our other practices.
How do you bring on a young doctor? So obviously you have a nice advantage, which is you have one of the best cataract refractive fellowships in the country. So you get great people applying. I know my former residents have applied and loved your fellowship too. So you can obviously take from those, but how do you bring them on board in a way that's what a lot of young doctors will complain about. They want something that's more fair and equitable to bring a partner on. They don't want to feel like they're just employees clocking in, clocking out. How do you do that?
Well, you asked the question with the answer in it, and I love that because, you know, if you want to attract stars, you, in my opinion, need to offer them a path to equality, a path to ownership, a path to partnership. If you are someone who kind of wants to be the person and they want to be the owner and they want to have everybody be employed, nothing wrong with that, but you're going to oftentimes attract a different personality. And so I think one of the keys to our, you know, success has been, you know, just this respect of, you know, what did I want at that stage? I wanted someone to care for me.
Sure.
I wanted them to offer me a path to partnership.
Yeah.
I wanted to be, you know, equal with them someday. And so as a result, you know, I have great partners. And again, I think both models obviously work beautiful because they're, you know, all over the world. But our model is more traditional, a path to partnership and equality.
I think that's so critical. I think a lot of ophthalmologists in our careers, I've been taken advantage of by a senior ophthalmologist with whom I was working, and it just didn't seem like it was going to go on that path to partnership or, as you say, the path to equality. And so that's why I think that in ophthalmology, that's so common that there's so many lone wolves. Of all medical practices, in ophthalmology, you have so many just solo guys and gals. And it's a lot of times they resort to this after they've just been taken advantage of. And I think it's going to be even more now in the world of new private equity taking over ophthalmology practices. And then young doctors coming out of training thinking like, I'm just going to be an employee forever? And they've kind of... I think your practice is the correct way of doing it. It's the way I think everyone wants, but I think it's becoming more rare. Do you think?
Well, it takes a lot of pressure. It takes a lot of pressure off of, you know, someone like, you know, me who, you know, simply wants to, you know, use the world's best technology, be able to recruit well to clinical trials, be able to afford the building of a good physical plant. I mean, these things are big responsibilities and big investments. And, you know, when, you know, I have a partner like my partner, John Birdall, and then Mike Greenwood and Russell Swan in Montana and Brandon Bartman in Omaha and Debbie Risfeld in Minnesota. And I could go on down the line when, you know, these amazing partners that I have, you know, you then get to afford the world's best because you're all putting your shoulder in it together. And when there's decisions to be made or you're going through stressful times, your arms locked, you're in the trenches together. And
yeah.
it makes it a joyful way to practice. And Uday, it just seems that the more that, you know, we want to, you know, give to each other, the better we all do. It's not like being the owner with employees, I think, is even the best financial model for the owner. I find that just by being giving to each other and caring to each other and caring about, you know, what each one of us and who each one of us love, I think that, you know, it just really matters having a relationship with your partners.
I think that's so key. I think that's refreshing to hear. And I think a lot of our young listeners on Cataract Coach and on our podcast, we skew towards the ophthalmologists who are basically 30s and 40s. And I think that's important for them to understand there are opportunities like this out there. You've just got to look for them. But you're right. I think you can recruit a much better team when you're actually going to have them as future partners. And like you said, you're arm in arm in the trenches. When there's a stressful thing, you can all share the stress. When there are big decisions to be made, you can all have a voice or an input. That's critical.
I think one of the other things that young ophthalmologists want is they want, you know, their expertise to be respected, and I have found that one of the best things that has worked for me in my journey is something that's kind of innate in me, and that is I'm really attracted to other people's excellence, and I believe there's excellence in everybody. And that if you create an environment where they feel a safe haven to, you know, allow their inner greatness to come out and play, and you are attracted to it versus, you know, having to be the excellence, I think that this philosophy that you know, I've enjoyed, and that is I'm willing to lead, I'm willing to follow. I literally just want what's best. And I think that young ophthalmologists and just, you know, young people on their journey, they want to be, you know, appreciated and allowed to, you know, experience the greatness in their career, and that's worked really, really well for me, being attracted to other people's excellence and being willing to lead or follow.
Yeah, that's a really critically important concept. Another thing for a young doctor is when you join someone who is more senior, you may be surprised the amount of learning you do in your first 5 years of practice is unfathomable. People, only in retrospect do you realize this, but when you finish your residency or fellowship, you think you're ready for everything. But yeah, you really just basically have the bare foundation. It's those first few years of practice. And to have a senior partner or have a team of other physicians, you can say, hey, let me pick your brains on this. I think that's such an important concept. One more thing. I was talking to someone recently, a young doctor, and I said, you know, if you're a baseball player and you bat 350, or for our non-baseball fans, meaning at 35% of the time you're on plate, up at bat, you can get a hit. That's amazing. If you're a basketball player and you shoot 90% from the free throw line, wow, you're good. If you're an ophthalmologist and you're 95%, you feel terrible. Right. So we have such a crazy high standard. It's like we have to be beyond 99% accurate all the time. And so one of the questions that we're talking about is, obviously there's a pressure to do that, but how do you deal with complications, which are not always iatrogenic? It can often be due to patient tissue or anatomy or protoplasm. How do you deal with that? And not just surgically, I mean, how do you deal with the patient interaction when you have a complicated case?
Well, you know, you bring up some really important things because there is a certain intensity to what we do. There's a power to what we do because there's, you know, a lot of patients will say they'd rather die than lose their vision. And sure. And so this sense that we work on is stunning. And so there's a certain aspect to what we do that's you know, routine. I mean, I'm a refractive surgeon, and better number one or better number two has a certain amount of routineness to it. But you want to be an expert at it. You want to go through the motions in surgery with confidence and expertise. So that kind of routineness is good. You just don't want it to be the sort of routineness that, you know, leads to, you know, boredom or not enjoying it. So I think having a beautiful curiosity and energy for what you do, I feel an absolute honor. I've had the honor of, you know, doing over 100,000 anterior segment surgeries. I work hard at what I do. And so, you know, it's amazing, Uday, that if someone would have told me at this stage of my career, I would feel this freshness and vibrancy for what I do. And so, so in general, there's a lot of joy, but when the tough stuff happens, you know, I think this is what separates a good from a great practice is, you gotta run towards the issue.
Right.
So it's one of the reasons that I've, you know, always had the philosophy that I'm going to delegate, you know, a lot of the routine things. I really don't do much for routine. I meet every patient. I look at all their diagnostics. I examine what I want to examine. I make the final decision. I deliver the surgery postoperatively. I don't do anything routine. All I see is, if there's an irregularity or in healing or a decision to make to, you know, optimize their vision. And so I'm attracted to those situations that I want to close the loop. And so the first thing to do is to just be a good communicator and sit down and connect and take the time. And it's one of the reasons that I don't do routine. I can do a lot of surgery in a week. Let's say I have 110 cases scheduled in a week, and I don't even feel pushed. I can, you know, help with finalizing the math and delivering the surgery and then, you know, dealing with those issues that need me, because my, you know, life isn't upside down trying to do all the routine also. And so I think that making the time to have a relaxed conversation with a patient in need is extremely important. And then just simply helping them understand, do you have, because they're wondering if they're, you know, going to lose their sight. Sure. And my job is to help them understand whether or not they have a hassle, something that, you know, I'm going to, you know, it's a healing issue, whatever, or if they have a true vision threatening problem. And I think categorizing it right away, that this is, you know, normal healing, or this is a real issue and you're going to be seeing me more often, and I'm going to shepherd this to be as the best it can be. But, you know, being just very open and honest is extremely important. And your team. I mean, so, you know, sometimes, you know, if there's a more sensitive personality in combination with a more sensitive situation that they're not doing great, that's where I want my more experienced technicians and doctors to be dealing with them. And so I'm even setting them up for success ahead of the time. And so, you know, that's where, you know, being a sensitive doctor and being a caring doctor, you're not just thinking about the moment you walk in the door. You're setting this up in every way possible, and you're giving them their mobile, you're texting them, they're a big part of your life until their situation is taken care of. I think that it's also important to just realize that we can do our best. And then, you know, I would say in the end, it's up to, you know, to God how they heal. And so, you know, I do, you know, sometimes, you know, have to just realize I can't control it all. I just do my best.
Yeah. I think one of the most critical things you said is you said run towards the patient with a complication. Because sometimes one of our instincts may be, you don't want to see the patient as much, but you got to do the opposite. You got to bring the patient closer to you, see them more often. And you also said you shepherd their care. So the patient just wants to know, let's say you have a patient, had a complication in surgery, needs to have a retina procedure now. The patient just wants to know that A, they're going to be okay, and B, you're going to shepherd their care. You're going to stand by them and help them through every step of this, and they have direct access to you. Those are probably the two critical points that sometimes we overlook.
That's exactly right, Uday. And I think the other is just setting up pre-experience expectations properly. And I'll use multifocality as, you know, an example. You know, when I transitioned from bifocals to trifocals, I'll never forget that first trifocal study, seeing that patient at 1 month post-op and their joy and their neural adaptation already something that I had never experienced with bifocal technology. But even then they still, you know, have, you know, glare and halos and things to deal with. And I tell every patient before they start that journey that in general, it's a three-step process. We're going to do this fancy implant that's going to help you see balance, distance, intermediate, and near. And then you're going to heal. And even though I'm doing all this math and surgery to get you to 2020, it's not unusual for you to end up 2025 or 2030 because of effective lens position. And sure. I teach them about that because of incisional healing. And so at 3 months, if you're not as crisp as you want to be, I do a fine tune, and it's not unusual. I'm doing that little YAG laser capsulotomy that they've already learned about. So it's not unusual that it's three steps per eye. You may not need all three. But after those three, or me managing your tear film, because I've considered that first 3 to 6 months, optimizing your image to 20/20 in each eye, you then have this time period where this reading part that gives you the reading range of a 32-year-old is so fun, is creating a halo around the lights at night. Yet the next stage is your brain adapting to that. And in the clinical trials that I did with these advanced trifocals, at the end of that journey, when they really looked at the monofocal controls versus the multifocal, the monofocal controls, 89% of them said they would do it that way again. 11% said they wouldn't because of the loss of intermediate and near in this cell phone and computer world. But in the trifocal group, 99.2% of them said they would do it that way again. 0.8% said they wouldn't. Wow. But the patient joy and satisfaction that happens with a modern day multifocal, when a patient understands that, you know, image optimization time period and then that neural adaptation time period and this three steps, and in general what I call the 1-year journey. Well, the reason I go through that long story and I do it with every patient is there's not so much anxiety post-op, because I can walk in the room and say, remember the 1 year? And they go, yep, 1 year. And, you know, it just is so helpful. So dealing with post-op anxiety is optimized by your pre-op preparation of expectations.
Yeah, I never even thought of it about presenting it as a 1-year journey, right? A few months of initial healing, tear film recovery, maybe capsulotomy, and then 6 months or more for the brain to fully adapt and kind of filter out the halo or glare at night. And no, it makes a lot of sense. But yeah, I think we're so focused on the short-term thing, or people have told us, oh, your post-op period is 90 days. But maybe it's not necessarily just 90 days. Maybe it's longer.
Neural adaptation is one of the most beautiful things, and that's why it's really important when you get into refractive surgery. Well, and we see it with contact lenses and glasses. I don't do contact lenses and glasses, but neural adaptation is something to really understand when you're correcting vision.
Well, and your practice also offers glaucoma care, right? So I know you do a lot of the MIGS devices and MIGS procedures. In a cataract refractive practice, or you say corneal refractive, fake IOL, lens replacement, is adding glaucoma, is it kind of in that same boat? Or is it, because those patients need lifetime kind of follow-up as opposed to, let's say, your LASIK patients where you don't. So how do you integrate seemingly a different patient population into a cataract refractive practice?
Well, for myself, since I'm busy at refractive, to tell you the truth, I don't do glaucoma. And so, you know, I have a tendency to walk out of the room when you start talking about glaucoma.
but your young ophthalmologist partners certainly are doing it. Yeah. A lot of it.
And that's one of the keys. I mean, I'm a believer in, you know, having experts take care of things. You know, could I do MIGS? I mean, you know, doing those types of things surgically, I think are, you know, in any cataract surgeon's, you know, ability. But there's also a lot of decisions that go around it for a comprehensive glaucoma journey. So in our practice, we have tended to focus that into the doctors that kind of specialize in that. And it's, I think it fits just beautifully. For one, you know, a lot of, you know, we know with myopia, there's a higher chance of glaucoma. We know with, you know, increasing age. And so a lot of cataract patients, you know, have glaucoma also. And so having that as a service in an advanced refractive and cataract surgery practice, I think makes a ton of sense and has been a beautiful addition to our practice.
Yeah, I think you mentioned something very important there, which is your practice can offer it or your colleagues can offer it, but you can focus on the things that you actually love or where your expertise is. I often, in the past, I would do a lot of the complicated, like sutured in IOLs and Yamane. I actually now send those out to a colleague who does like 3 or 4 of them a week. And I think the patients are better served that way. So I think, yeah, picking and choosing what you want to really specialize in and really have a deep expertise in is probably the best bet.
That's why one of our guiding values is excellence. And so we really want the person who's the most excellent doing it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But again, that goes back to your whole teamwork. You got a team of your entire team of all people, but then also the team of doctors, which makes a ton of sense. So can we expect Vance Thompson Vision to expand into retina next?
Yes. And so, you know, it never was really on our radar. You know, a lot of our growth has happened organically.
Sure.
I've had this philosophy over the years that it's really right people over right timing. And so when if you have a practice need and you wait for it to be fever pitch, that you're increasing your chances you're going to take someone that's maybe second best for you. And so when you have someone come along that your chemistry fits like a puzzle piece, you may sacrifice for a while because you didn't have the practice need, but it won't be long because of the beautiful energy coming from your relationship, you know, emanating to your employees and your referring doctors and your patients, that your practice grows. So I'm a big believer in right people over right timing. And the same thing is happening to us in retina. We have a young man who's going to be joining us, who's just finishing his retina fellowship in July. And so we're starting our retina journey. And one of the things that attracts him, there's a strong refractive surgery basis to our practice. And what I mean by that, I feel like refractive surgery got this a little bit earlier than the rest of medicine. And that is, you know, how to talk with patients about a procedure that insurance doesn't cover, and how to create a patient experience, or how to create a referring doctor education program, and how do you market and message and develop a website. But when you start using those principles in cataract surgery and in glaucoma, and now this idea of retina, because retina doctors are, you know, kind of busy no matter what, it seems.
Sure.
But to take a lot of these same philosophies that make a quality refractive surgery practice, but incorporate it into a retina practice, is one of the things that really excites this young retina doctor. And I'm super excited to help him with that story problem of how we take what we've learned and incorporate it into his retina journey.
Wow. I think one of the really critical things you said, which I want to repeat, is that, yeah, you don't normally, the normal thinking is wait till you have such a huge need for someone and then go get someone. But you may not get the best person. So you say the opposite. When you find someone amazing, team up with that person, even if you don't have the strongest need just at this point, because the need will come.
Right. That is exactly right.
That's a different way of thinking. I really never thought of it that way. Because the
over right timing. Yep.
Yeah, that is. Now that you say it, it sounds critically obvious. It sounds very obvious. But honestly, before this conversation, I never thought of that. I would think, no, wait till you need someone, then get someone.
Yeah. Well, it all starts with great people. You know.
Yeah.
So, you know, we haven't had some strategy to go to, you know, other states. But when we fall in love with someone and they fall in love with us and they want to go to that state, if it's a great person, it's as close to guaranteeing success as there is.
Sure.
Because it all starts with that, you know, kind of leader ophthalmologist, and then it grows from there. And it is just so fun. And I have to tell you, I have come to the conclusion, because one of my biggest worries was losing that culture feel as we grew.
Sure.
But I now know that what really has led to our success, even though we're not in the same building, is number one, you know, love, and number two, structure. And what I mean by that is we're really taking risk together, because we're in this together. And when you you know, have a deep relationship with someone, and there's a beautiful structure, and you have shared risk, I now put geography as number three. I just never would have thought I'd feel as close to my partner two stages over as I do my partner 10 feet from me. Sure. And so this idea of caring for each other and shared risk, that's why, you know, when you decide you want to do that with someone, you've heard partnerships like a marriage. And so when you decide if you just are going for the right, you know, timing, you increase the chance that it's going to be the wrong person. And so when you feel that right person, right connection, because we're being opportunities going by us every day, and it's up to us to say, is that a real opportunity or is that just a temptation I should just stay away from? They're not the right person. But when it's the right person, it's just beautiful when you have a great relationship and you have shared risk.
Do you have all your ophthalmologists get on like a video conference call every week, or how do you stay connected when they're states away?
Yeah. Well, so we do a lot through text and email, and then we also all have a video monitor in each one of our offices, and so we can all see each other all the time. And then we have, you know, scheduled, you know, calls, also like Zoom, and we have our, you know, those are monthly meetings, but there's multiple ways we're communicating with each other every day.
Oh, yes. Obviously, staying connected is very important. So like group yes. texts, group emails, et cetera, kind of picking the... I'm most jealous of, if you have such a great team, like you have a tough case come up, you'd say, what should I do? You can just email your team and say, hey, here's the tough case. What do you guys think?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yep.
That's really neat. So to wrap this up, what pearls do you give to a young 30-something, maybe 40-something ophthalmologist who wants to replicate what you've got there? And Advanced Thompson Vision, with the patient experience, the team, the culture, what good pearls you got for that?
So Coach John Wooden, the UCLA Bruins winningest NCAA coach ever,
sure,
said, you have to love your team to get the best out of them. And so this was a wonderful coach working with tough guys, and he knew the importance of love to get the best out of people. And I think that, you know, as you do your journey through medicine and now you're just starting your practice, I think we underestimate the power of relationships.
Sure.
And so, you know, doing, you know, that smile and eye contact and not just walking by someone, if you do, lose your temper, that you say, I'm sorry. And so these things that are basic relational things, I think, is the most important thing, because you've obviously, you know, had great training and you're, you know, ready for the world of taking care of eyes. But first remembering that team that loves and cares for each other is going to create an environment where patients feel loved and cared for. And you know, a lot of the great companies in the world have figured this out. You know, 80% of the Fortune 500 companies have a very focused customer experience. And so, you know, I just think when a patient comes into a center like that and they say, I love how they treat each other.
Yeah.
I love how they treat me. I trust them to do my eye surgery. And I'm going to tell my friends. You don't create a great team and patient experience, just thinking about the business. You think about the relationship. But people. Oh, by the way, it's great business. And so I think that's what I would tell young beginning surgeon, is don't underestimate the power of people and listen to your staff and patient complaints. We know that when we get a complaint, we're going to address it, and we're going to try to make it the relationship with that patient end up better than it was if the complaint hadn't happened. So we know we're going to work hard on the complaint, but you got to do step two, and that is, what led to the complaint? It's they are giving you some of the most beautiful information to go work on your experience and minimize that chance happening to other patients.
Sure.
And so I think listening to your complaints and dealing with them is also important. But if you go into the practice of medicine and realizing the power of people with your partners, your staff, and your patients, you will have figured out some something that a lot of doctors don't figure out in their career.
Wow. So yes, it people first. And like you said at the beginning, a little mushy, but actually love. Yes. I mean, I never thought this in our interview that we'd be talking about like just love. But you're right. That's really what it all boils down to. Wow, Vance, this was fantastic. I want to thank you again for taking the time. We're going to post this up on our podcast series, which is available on Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon. Plus, it'll be on our YouTube channel. Plus, it'll be on Cataract Coach as a video as well. And again, I want to thank you. I will certainly have to put it on my calendar to come visit you guys so I can glean more pearls. But even then, I just made a note to myself here. I'm making a post-op video to send to patients today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Uday. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
All right. Take care now. Thanks for enjoying that podcast with me. I trust that you learned some valuable information that you can incorporate into your own practice to give your patients an even better experience. And then next podcast, we're going to have a focus on residency and where's it going and what are the challenges. And we're also going to talk about ocular trauma. We have a fantastic guest, and I think you're going to really love that podcast coming up next.